Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
you are uprooted and have come to belong.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Last week, a few days on the other side of Easter, I shared this quote from author Barbara Brown Taylor in our weekly email newsletter. She writes, "Resurrection is always announced with Easter lilies, the sound of trumpets, bright streaming light. But it did not happen that way. If it happened in a cave, it happened in complete silence, in absolute darkness, with the smell of damp stone and dug earth in the air, sitting deep in the heart of Oregon Cave," she writes. "I let this sink in. New life starts in the dark. Whether it is a seed in the ground, a baby in the womb, or Jesus in the tomb, it starts in the dark." And I've been thinking a lot about that recently. But the thing I've kept circling back to the most is, what do we do while we're in the dark? When it doesn't feel like there's any light shining through even the smallest crevice inside the cave that we can see, what do we do? What do we do that doesn't sound foolish or naive, that's not simply waiting around for something magical to happen? What do we do when we can't muster up any hope and just find ourselves in the dark? And as I wrestled with that, I kept coming back to the stories that we find at the end of Luke's gospel account of the life of Jesus, because I think there's some wisdom that you and I can glean from there. So I'm going to read through them for us, and then I'm going to walk us back through to see if there's any wisdom that we may be able to pick up on from these ancient stories, starting in Luke 23, verse 44. It reads, "It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' When he had said this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, 'Surely this was a righteous man.' When all the people who had gathered to witness the sight saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance, watching these things. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man who had not consented to their decision and action. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea, and he himself was waiting for the kingdom of God. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen cloth, and placed it in a tomb cut in the rock, one in which no one yet had been laid. It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. The women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and saw the tomb and how his body was laid in it. Then they went home and prepared spices and perfumes, but they rested on the Sabbath in obedience to the commandment. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. In their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, 'Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still with you in Galilee? The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again. Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to the 11 and to the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles, but they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away wondering to himself what had happened. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel." Now, to help us feel the weight of the situation, we have to put ourselves in the mindset of these two followers of Jesus at this particular moment. And these were two people who had left everything to follow Jesus. And after 3 years of following Jesus, they had come to believe that Jesus was the long-awaited Messiah, the rescuer. You see, for generations, the Jewish people had been brutally oppressed by Rome, and the Jewish hope was that God would send a Messiah, a rescuer, that he would come as a conquering military king, that he would overthrow the Roman oppressors, and that the Jewish people would rule in Jerusalem as God's chosen people. And so in following Jesus, there was a very tangible sense that these disciples in them, that their time had finally come, that Jesus was the one to put them as a people back on top and end this oppression they had suffered under. But instead, Jesus ends up being crucified and killed on a Roman cross. Now today, a cross for Christians serves as a symbol of hope, a symbol of victory through sacrificial love. But again, we have to put ourselves in the context of these guys at this moment. If you're them, a cross was not a sign of great victory over oppressors. Rather, the cross was a sign of the oppressor's victory over you. Specifically, Rome's victory over you with power and violence. And so when Jesus died, understand, their hope died with him. Look again what's said there in verse 21. "But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel." Those three simple yet also profound and relatable words, "we had hoped." We had hoped. But Rome had its way again. The empire, the powers that be, the oppressive systems, and those committed to propping it up had their way again. We had hoped that this time it would be different, that Jesus was going to come through for us the way we wanted him to come through for us. But here we are again, and it seems even worse now than before. Were these last 3 years just a waste? Is this just always going to be the way things are? We had hoped. And I think there's lots of us listening today who can relate to that feeling, to those three words. We had hoped. We had hoped that job interview number 15 would finally be the one. That our finances and future would feel way more secure than they do. I mean, we had hoped that we wouldn't find ourselves coming up on another election cycle in the same place we were 4 years ago. And yet, here we are again. We had hoped that fractured relationships with family and loved ones could have found a way to heal by now rather than the divide only seeming to grow farther apart. We had hoped. We'd hoped that the sickness, the addiction, the disease, the mental health battle would no longer feel so all-consuming and overwhelming. I mean, we had hoped that the wounds and the fear would feel like they were in the rearview mirror by now, that our feelings would have changed, that we would have gotten past it all, that they would have gotten past it. We'd hoped. I mean, we'd hoped that in 2024, we wouldn't be having to expend so much energy to simply try to convince people about the reality of racial injustice, the dangers of Christian nationalism, and the full equality of all genders and orientations of people. We had hoped that the churches and Christians that raised many of us could handle us asking sincere questions about faith and the frameworks passed down to us, that they could handle us wrestling with what it looks like to follow Jesus' foundational teaching of love your neighbor as yourself in our particular context today without labeling us as dangerous or heretics. We had hoped. Friends, we have hoped so many things. And often we can be left wondering, is this always the way it's going to be? And it's very tempting to just give in to that, to spiral down into cynicism and let that cynicism shape how we view everything to the point where we simply start to believe in our hearts, this is how it always will be. Things are always going to be this way. Rome is always going to win. So again, what do we do when that's where we find ourselves? What do we do when all we can see is darkness and we can't muster up any credible hope that things are going to change? And to help with that, I want to go back and I want to offer you three observations from these stories that I read a few moments ago, this account in the scriptures that's been passed down for thousands of years, and see if perhaps they can offer us any wisdom of what to do when it can feel like hope is lost. So first, we have the women who went to Jesus' tomb early in the morning on that first day of the week. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine named Stan Mitchell recently, and he pointed out how important it is for us to notice that these women went to the tomb that morning with zero hope or expectation of a resurrected Jesus. And they had seen him die on a cross. They had seen him buried and lying in the tomb afterwards. They weren't coming there to the tomb that morning because they had hope that things would be different. Their hopes for who Jesus was and how things could possibly change for the better had been crushed. Their hopes were gone. So in the midst of that darkness, that loss of hope, why did they show up? Well, the text says they were bringing perfume and spices to anoint Jesus' body with. It was a way of showing honor and respect and care for their friend. Even though in their mind, Jesus had disappointed them and had let them down, they showed up to care for his body because it was a kind and loving thing to do. It honored their tradition. It honored the dignity of his life in the best way they knew how in the moment. That's why they did it. Not because they anticipated resurrection. Not because they anticipated angels or an empty tomb. And I think that's important for us to keep in front of us because, yes, sometimes the amazing and unexpected happens and our worlds get turned upside down for the better when we least expect it. But sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes the circumstances don't change. And it's hard and disappointing and frustrating. And that's why I find what these women did compelling, because that's where they were in this moment, because there was no other place to be other than the moment they were in. And in that moment, they showed up simply to love. So I want to suggest to all of us today that when we find ourselves in the dark without hope, a question worth asking in those moments is, how do I do the next kind and loving thing in front of me? Because you see, that's something that centers us back into the here and now. This isn't about simply wishing that things could be different than they actually are. This is a choice and a decision to show up, to be kind, to demonstrate love, to help generate the kind of world that we actually want to live in. And so we keep asking the question, how do I do the next kind and loving thing in front of me? And then we do that. We do the next kind and loving thing. Because that's something all of us can do. So that's one observation from this story. Here's another. So the women who encountered the angels in the empty tomb, the text names Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and then it says the others that were with them. They all ran off to tell the disciples what they had seen and heard. Because at this point, the 11 disciples were hiding out. It used to be 12, but now Judas is no longer there, so it's just the 11. And so the women share all of this with them, and then the text says this, but they did not believe the women, because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Now, I want to say here that the following parallels I'm going to try to make with this text don't line up cleanly, but I think the principle has great and important value. So a while back, I was sharing with a friend in ministry about how I'd find myself lately, and I found myself lately in a lot of conversations with pastors from all different parts of the country. And one of the consistent themes that had been coming up in these conversations was that many of these pastors had found themselves in their own frustrations and disappointments with the institution of church, wrestling with whether they should leave ministry altogether. My friend, who is a person of color, gently asked me, "Hey, I'm curious, are most of these pastors that you're talking to white?" So I did kind of a quick inventory in my mind and said, yeah, I mean, there's some exceptions, but yeah, mostly they're white. And my friend goes, "You know, when I talk to people of color like me in ministry, I don't tend to hear that from them." Now, to be clear, both of us fully agree that there's real trauma and abuse that people experience in ministry and throughout church that make leaving these toxic situations the best and healthiest thing to do for anyone. But I still couldn't shake that conversation. So a few days later, I asked another friend in ministry who's a woman of color what her perspective was on the conversation I'd had just a few days earlier. And she said, "Yeah, that's been my experience too. A lot of my white friends find themselves responding to the events of these last several years shocked, like, I just can't believe this is happening. But myself and my friends who are people of color are like, well, we're not shocked. I can absolutely believe that this has happened." And she went on to explain, "We've never expected the system to act justly. We've never expected the government or the institution of church to have our backs. All we've ever had was Jesus. So I don't really hear much talk about leaving because we're just used to the fight being hard." And those conversations have continued to stick with me the past couple years. And what they prompt me to do is to regularly come back to this question of, am I intentionally listening to the voices of marginalized and oppressed people? And in this context particularly, when circumstances get difficult, am I choosing to intentionally listen to people on the margins or people who have been oppressed in a variety of different ways? Because the thing is, all of us experience difficulty in different ways. All of us do. No one is exempt from that. But there are both current and previous systems that have made it so that there isn't equality in our culture based on things like gender, race, ethnicity, relationship status, sexual orientation, etc. And the reality is, certain systems of day-to-day life have been designed to keep that inequality in place, resulting in generations of people in particular groups having to learn how to navigate unnecessary, unjust, constant, and continual hardship. And yet, more often than not, many in those same groups have also found ways to steadfastly show up with love, with peace, with generosity, to not throw in the towel and just give up, but to keep going and showing up. I want to be someone who continues to learn how to handle hard better. And in my context, that means consistently seeking out and listening to marginalized and oppressed people. And what struck me in this text is knowing how marginalized women were at this point in history, and then how easily their words were just dismissed by nearly all of the guys, these disciples who found themselves in their own darkness, in their own hopelessness, and then being reminded how critical it is in whatever darkness we find ourselves in to make sure that we're listening to voices who have been forced to learn how to navigate constant hardship and glean wisdom on what it means to still show up with love. Now, obviously, there is a ton more we could try to unpack there, right? But for the sake of time, I want to draw our attention to one more phrase in the story that I think reinforces the same wisdom that we've tried to excavate from this text today. And we find it in this part of the story where the resurrected Jesus comes alongside these two men walking along the road toward this village of Emmaus. But in some way, it says that they're kept from recognizing Jesus. But the two men are discussing the events that had just taken place in Jerusalem, how their hopes for the future were dashed when Jesus was crucified. And then we come across this line in the story. It says, they stood still, their faces downcast. Now, here's the thing I want us to think about. Something happens when you and I choose to stop walking, when we choose to stand still. We lose our imagination. Like, we lose any sense of creativity in terms of how things could ever be different. We often find ourselves paralyzed in a moment, unable to find any traction forward, but any hope that is worth having is a hope that walks. It's a hope that shows up and puts one foot in front of the other and takes action. And sometimes that's literal, right? That if we're physically able, sometimes it's important for our own mental health and perspective to just literally take a walk. Like, perhaps if you're able, one of the best things that you could do today, this week, is to just find time to literally take a walk, to embody in your very being forward movement. Or even if it's just figurative and symbolic, it's important that we find a way to keep showing up and moving forward. Because if hope is any kind of hope, it's a hope that understands that hope is earned, where it's a hope that can acknowledge that a situation may be broken and messed up, where in the dark it's a hope that can grieve and mourn the way that things are, where it's a hope that fights to see new possibilities, that acknowledges the darkness but refuses to give in to cynicism that darkness is all there is. And it's a hope that recognizes that even if current circumstances don't change, I can be changed. We can be changed. And that's possible when our hope walks. When it walks. And understand, more often than not, that walk won't feel like a frolicking through the daisies kind of hope, but rather much more like a tired, questioning, one foot barely in front of the other kind of hope. A determined trudge, crawling on our knees through the desert kind of hope, but it's one that keeps walking. So a gift to give to one another and a gift that we give to ourselves is to keep walking. Because when we stop walking, hope stops with it. We didn't read all of the story up front with these two men and Jesus on the road to Emmaus, but there comes a point in the story where they still don't recognize him yet as Jesus. And it says this, as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going further, but they urged him strongly, stay with us, for it's nearly evening. The day is almost over. So he went in to stay with them. And again, I found myself struck by, here's these guys with their hope and faith shattered. I mean, they're probably spiraling quite a bit. And yet, here they still choose to welcome to who all they recognize was a stranger, someone they didn't recognize, someone they didn't know, but they still choose to welcome this stranger into their home. They still choose to just be kind, to be hospitable, to show up with love, even when hope and faith were gone for them. In one of the more well-known passages in the New Testament, Paul writes, "And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love." Because here's the thing, friends. You and I, we can lose faith at times. And we can lose hope at times. But here's to us being a community that doesn't lose love. No matter how challenging a situation may get, let's not lose love. Because the reality is, love creates a faith worth believing in. And it creates a hope worth having. So let's always keep coming back to love, wherever we find ourselves. Trusting that when Jesus summed up everything in the scriptures with the simplicity of love one another, he actually knew what he was talking about. And now these three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Your love, Crosspoint. See you next week.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.